This is Up to Date on KCUR 89.3. In theory, Rachel Pruchno was well positioned to recognize her adopted daughter's mental illness. A psychologist herself, Pruchno had her daughter, Sophia, examined by psychiatrists and psychologists and social workers. She had been treated for years, but it wasn't until Sophie was 16 that she finally received a diagnosis of bipolar disorder. Rachel Pruchno now has a new book out, Beyond Madness, The Pain and Possibilities of Serious Mental Illness. It's a follow-up to her previous book, Surrounded by Madness, A Memoir of Mental Illness and Family Secrets. In her latest book, Pruchno describes what it's like for the more than 13 million adults and children who suffer from mental illness and the care these people can receive. Dr. Rachel Pruchno is a decades-long mental health professional. Dr. Pruchno, so nice to have you on the show. Welcome.
Thank you, Steve. It's great to be here.
So before we get into the weeds here, what is your elevator pitch for Beyond Madness, your new book? What is it about, and what goals are you hoping to accomplish with this new book?
So the premise of Beyond Madness is that while there's a lot that we do not know about serious mental illness, there's a lot we do know. And that information, that knowledge, does not get to the people who need it. It doesn't get to the families who are struggling and don't know what to do when somebody says they're thinking about harming themselves. It doesn't get to the teachers in our communities, the clergy, the police, who often are the first responders. And so what I've tried to do with this book, and this book is written for lay people, what I've tried to do is to read and to understand what do we really know, and then translate that so that it's useful to people.
You know, I think the difficulty for so many families, for so many parents, is when mental illness first rears its head inside a family, there's so much confusion as to what's going on. People don't know where to turn, they don't know what to do, and you're trying to help that.
Absolutely. They don't know. And having experienced it again, you know, you would think that as a psychologist, I might have had some clue, but Sophie was our eldest child. And, you know, where's the line between normal troubled adolescence and serious mental illness? I think that a big struggle for people is we don't know what. It's very hard to get a diagnosis. It's very hard to understand what we're dealing with.
One of the most arresting parts of this new book is your description of what it's like to suffer from one of these illnesses. Early on, you describe schizophrenia, and you tell a story about a boy named Joe. He's 17. He's convinced that he's God, as so many folks who suffer from this tend to think. He's reading an American history textbook one evening, and he's watching his grandmother across the room, who's reading her Reader's Digest. And Joe is suddenly convinced that his grandmother has become possessed by Satan. Tell us what happened here.
So Joe is a real person, by the way, and I just want to be clear. There are three heroes to this book. Joe is a man with schizophrenia who I found he had written a memoir of his own, and I sought him out, and I asked him if he would be willing to explain to me what it was like. I knew when I was preparing to write this book that I would tell my story and my daughter's story, but we didn't experience schizophrenia. We didn't experience depression. And so I needed to really understand people who had experienced those illnesses. So Joe and I struck up a relationship, and he was kind enough to spend hours and hours of his time explaining to me what it was like, to be in that room at that time. He's a 17-year-old kid, and he's hearing voices, and the voices are telling him that the grandmother that he loved, this is a grandmother who was raising him, mm-hmm. because his own mother suffered from schizophrenia. And the voices were telling him that she was the devil and that he needed to kill her. And there were guns in the house, and he almost did kill her.
You know, this idea is so interesting to me, that someone suffering from schizophrenia or bipolar, and he or she suddenly thinks they are God. It's fairly typical. What do we know about why this particular manifestation takes over?
I don't really know that we know.
Yeah.
There are a lot of different delusions that people might have. So some people believe that others are following them, or that the FBI is watching them. The John Nash story is a great example
Right.
of what those delusions look like. But I don't really know why this religious,
Right.
belief that God is talking to me, I'm not quite sure we understand why that manifests the way it does.
And just to point out here, Joe's a really good kid, right? He's a star player on the basketball team. He's been a good son to his grandmother, in a sense, for years.
Absolutely. So this is the rub about serious mental illness. It can strike any of us. It doesn't know black and white and different ethnicities, and it doesn't know good, smart and not smart people. Joe was your typical kid. He was a bad, like you said, he was a basketball star. He was a good student. We just never know, and that's why people. It's really important for everybody in the community to understand what these illnesses are, to better appreciate them. I think for so long we've just said, "Oh, it can't happen to me," or and then a tragedy happens, and then people say, "Well, why, how could that have happened?" Well, it's easy to understand a tragedy if you understand that frequently people with schizophrenia who are not treated hear voices. And the voices tell them to do things. And if you had somebody screaming in your ear saying, you are a horrible, nasty, miserable person, and this is what you have to do, I think it would be hard for any of us to deal with that.
And I think a lot of people assume that it's what the thinking broadly back in the day was that it was lousy parenting that led to this. And one point of your book here is that that really has got nothing to do with this.
Absolutely. But yet that belief, I think, sticks with us. Honestly, Steve, that was my belief when my husband and I were dealing with our daughter. We didn't tell people about some of the strange behaviors that she was doing because we were embarrassed and we thought people would think we were lousy parents.
Right.
And that secrecy caused all sorts of problems throughout the family because if you're keeping secrets and you're doing strange things and people don't understand it, it just creates all sorts of rifts. And I just, I think what I've learned through this whole experience, and it, for me, you got to understand this, my experience with serious mental illness started with my mother. When I was 12, my mother was diagnosed with manic depression. Now, manic depression got a new label, a new label, and is now called bipolar disorder, right? But when my mother was ill, we told nobody. That was a secret in my family. Nobody ever said you have to keep it a secret, but I wasn't going to tell anybody. And then my husband and I continued those secrets. But what I've learned through this whole experience is that the worst thing we can do when somebody has a serious mental illness is keep secrets.
Right. Dr. Rachel Pruchnow is my guest. Her new book, Beyond Madness: The Pain and Possibilities of Serious Mental Illness. You mentioned your daughter was 16 when she was diagnosed with bipolar. When you were trying to help her, you encountered all manner of intolerance and misinformation. What was that like for you? How did you navigate those moments?
I gotta tell you, it was so frustrating. And you have to understand, I work in a medical school, so that I thought that would open doors for me. I thought I could talk to the psychiatrists here and get some recommendations. No, that didn't happen. So the frustrations begin when a person is trying to find a clinician. So I can't tell you how many calls I made to psychiatrists' offices, and only to be told, "Well, this doctor has a waiting list of 6 months. Would you like to be on our waiting list?" And I'm thinking to myself, "You know what? In 6 months, this kid could kill herself."
Right. So what advice do you have for a parent or a sibling or a spouse or a friend who they find out that someone has mental illness, Rachel, you know, what's the path forward? What are the first steps you recommend as they begin trying to navigate what's oftentimes an intractable mental health care system?
Yeah, I think developing patience is important, but also perseverance. I think that people need to be prepared for a long journey to find good care. You know, the psychiatrists don't want to talk to the therapist, and the therapists don't want to talk to the psychiatrist. Why? Because insurance doesn't pay for it. And so, I mean, it is a long, nasty journey. But I think what's really important, and I wish I had known that at the time, was that you're not alone. You're not the only person going through this. And somehow I think that, you know, when there are other people that are going through it, and if people know other people, this is why I'm on this new sort of campaign to get people to talk about serious mental illness and to let people know that people do suffer from these illnesses. At that point, I mean, it creates a support that I think is really important. So for people, for families that are struggling, you know, what I say is let people know and accept the support in your natural support system from your friends, from your relatives, these people will be very willing to provide. But if you don't tell them, they can't help you.
But a lot of times, you know, that stigma about mental illness, boy, it can disrupt relationships you read about. You know, it can really cause some issues.
Absolutely does. You know, now there have been studies over the past, 50 years or so. And if anything, the stigma of mental illness is worse. So if you ask people how likely they are to want to have somebody with schizophrenia marry into their family or be their neighbor or be a colleague at work, they are as likely now to say no as they were 50 years ago. So stigma is alive and well. But I think that, and again, I think that telling and talking, I'm not saying, you know, scream from the window, but I think that telling a trusted friend is important, because families who have someone with a serious mental illness need that support. And I think that, you know, I also think there's enough knowledge to know that the more contact people have with those who have serious mental illness, the more acceptable it becomes.
At the same time, you do get, and we've talked on this show just as recently as last week, Rachel, you do get a sense that society is coming around to the idea of how pervasive mental illness is in our society. And at least the young people in my classes, I teach up at UMKC here, they talk about it pretty openly.
I agree with you. I think the young people are talking about it more, and that's awesome. We have a lot to learn from the young people. And I noticed that with my daughter and her friends too. I remember one time when she was checking into camp and they were all checking in their meds, and they were all on these psychotropic meds, and they were freely talking about it. It's like, that's very good. But I wonder how many of their parents are talking about it, and how many of, you know, because it's the parents that are going to need the support, because it's a long, horrible journey.
So these illnesses can pop up, what, at any point in somebody's life? What do we know about that?
So in terms of schizophrenia, it's most likely to make itself evident for men in sort of 18 to 22, for women a little later. But some of these other illnesses can be evident much earlier. We do know that nearly 2 million children have diagnosable serious mental illnesses. And so, you know, there really is a range. And just to go to the other age range, sometimes with my mother, in my mother's case, she was perfectly fine until she was 43. And boom, right? And there are, and to the, to the greater extreme, there are some people who in their 60s first have an episode of psychosis. So it really is a lifelong But the potential is lifelong. The most frequent time for a first episode is early 20s.
And why is that? Does it have something to do with hormonal changes in the body? Do we even know that, or are you saying we're still not sure?
Yeah, I think we don't know. This
Yeah.
is part of the stuff that we don't know. Again, there's a lot we don't know. We don't know. We don't know what causes these. We think it's a combination of genes and nurture. It's a combination. But we really don't know. You know, it's not like there's one gene that says, oh, if you have that gene, you're going to become schizophrenic. It doesn't. On the other hand, we know that these illnesses coexist within families.
So
Right. So
there's
if a parent, yeah.
really no way to predict when any one person is going to develop a serious mental illness during their lifetimes. It just there's just no way of knowing.
That's absolutely right.
You know, you have some thoughts about when education about mental illness should begin. Rachel, talk to me about that.
So I think that when I reflect on it, I think probably in middle school when kids are, I know I'll think about my daughter now, for example. I know that when she was in middle school, there were a group of kids who, girls, who were, they were all cutting themselves. And the school didn't know how to deal with it. You know, the parents would get called in and they would be encouraged to get help for them. But I really think that it's important, just as we do sex education starting in middle school, that we talk about mental health at that point, and that we continue into to high school and provide the opportunity for people who are having these experiences to know that they're not alone and that they are supported and that they are still loved and cared for, even though they're struggling with these illnesses.
At one point in the book, you talk about the problems facing the crisis care system, and they are substantial. Although in Kansas, we're finding out that changes are underway. But you mentioned a story about the son of a Virginia state senator, no less. The senator's name is Cray Deeds, if I'm saying that right,
You are.
and how he wasn't able to find a hospital bed for his son. Tell us about what happened to him in that situation.
Yeah, so Cray Deeds' son, Gus, suffered from serious mental illness. He wanted help. His parents wanted to get him help. They took him to the emergency room, and they were in the emergency room for hours and hours and hours. And they, the social workers there looked, and they could not find a bed in all of Virginia, a psychiatric hospital bed for Gus. And so they said, "You'll have to take him home." And Mr. Deeds, Cray Deeds, said, "I'll take him home," and he did. And Cray Deeds was so frightened that evening that he did something he'd never done before. He locked his bedroom door because he didn't want his son to come in. And he went to sleep, and then the next morning, he woke up, and he lived on a farm. And Cray Deeds was out doing something on the farm, and Gus starts walking towards him. He has a gun and he has a knife, and the son, Gus, landed up slashing his father's face. I mean, if you can Google Cray Deeds and you see he still has the scars. And then Gus turned the gun on himself and killed himself. Horrible, horrible, every parent's nightmare, right?
And maybe this is a good time to clarify, you know, people oftentimes are afraid of other folks who are suffering from mental illness. And the stats show there's really no reason to be, generally speaking.
That's right. So when people with serious mental illnesses like schizophrenia and bipolar disorder are treated, they are no more dangerous than you and me. However, when they're not treated, and when they're having active hallucinations and psychoses and delusions, they are more dangerous.
Let me grab a phone call here, Rachel. This is from Lee from Overland Park. Lee, good morning.
Good morning.
Go quickly if you would, Lee.
I just really my question and comment actually is the difficulty in really finding good health care for especially your
Lee, you there? Maybe I think it's fair to say the question is, how do you find good health care when the system is so jammed up, Rachel? What do you say to that?
Yeah, and I wish, Lee, I wish I could give you a really good answer, and I wish I could give you a phone number to call, or somebody's going to be waiting and be able to help you, and that doesn't happen. So I think what we need is we need a groundswell of support to better the mental that healthcare that's available to people with serious mental illnesses. We need to say enough. We need better care. And again, for the people that are suffering right now, it's this persistence, and talk to everybody that you know and get referrals and make phone calls and talk. You'll talk to a lot of people. But there is no simple answer. And whether it's in Kansas City or in Philadelphia or in New York, the problem is across our country.
Yeah, I was going to say, we've talked on this show about students at UMKC, the university here, terrific healthcare center, mental health care center, but kids can't get in. The appointments are backed up for months, and you're saying you're seeing that across the country.
Yep, we're seeing that at my university as well. They
Yeah.
can't get appointments because there are so many. And Steve, maybe this is a little bit of the issue that you pointed out earlier, that these college kids are, they want help. They want to
Right,
reach out. They're
right.
not hiding. And they reach out, and they get their hand slapped or the door slammed on them.
Well,
It's
that's Dr.
horrible.
Rachel Pruchnow. I wish we had more time here. Her new book, Beyond Madness: The Pain and Possibilities of Serious Mental Illness. Rachel, thanks so much for your time today. Really enjoyed having you and talking about this very important issue.
Thank you so much, Steve.
You bet. Up to Date is a production of KCUR 89.3. Our theme music was composed by the great Bobby Watson. The program is produced by Danny Alexander, Zach Wilson, Elizabeth Ruiz, and Reginald David. Our engineer is Paul Nakatura. I'm Steve Kraske. Thanks for listening.